Hold on a second. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. Why don't we get started? I'd like to call to order the Biden Administration Committee meeting, December 5th, 2013. First, we have the safety contact from Mr. Doherty.
Thanks, Chair Acosta, and good morning, members of the board. In the event the fire alarm would go off, we would ask that you exit either by the doors that you came in or the two exits here and meet next to the green schoolhouse across the street at the National Building Museum, of course, using the crosswalks and crossing safely. Our safety contact this morning is prevention of the flu and germs. The Center for Disease Control recommends a three-step approach for fighting the influenza. The first and most important step is to get a flu vaccination each year, but if you get the flu, there are antiviral drugs that can treat your illness. Early treatment is especially important for the elderly, the very young, and people with certain chronic health conditions, as well as pregnant women. Finally, everyday preventive actions may slow the spread of germs that cause respiratory illnesses like the flu. Flu viruses are thought to spread mainly from person to person through the coughing, sneezing, or talking of someone with the flu. Flu viruses may spread when people touch something with the flu virus on it and touch their mouth, eyes, or nose. Many other viruses spread these ways too. Some everyday preventive actions that you can take are to cover your nose and mouth with a tissue when you cough or sneeze into your elbow. Wash your hands often with soap and water. If soap and water are not available, use an alcohol-based hand gel. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Try to avoid close contact with sick people. If you get sick with the flu, limit contact with others as much as possible, and then routinely clean touched objects and surfaces like doorknobs, keyboards, and phones. And by following these steps, when at home, you can greatly reduce your chance of acquiring the flu virus. Thank you. That concludes my safety contact, Mr. Acosta.
Thank you, Mr. Doherty. Before the committee is the agenda for today's meeting. Are there any questions or additions or deletions to today's agenda? If not, I will move forward with the agenda as presented. Next up is the approval of the November 7th, 2013 meeting minutes. I would entertain a motion. Moved by Ms. Hines. Second by Mr. Bolter. Any questions about the minutes? All in favor?
Aye.
The minutes pass. Today we have four action items before the committee, but of course the major purpose of today's meeting is to hear Richard's presentation of his proposed FY15 budget, which advances his business plan initiatives and our collective strategic priorities. High on the list is that this budget represents the first real down payment on the Metro 2025 projects, including preparing the system for 8 car trains during rush hour. The proposal also continues to focus on safety, with work to close the remaining NTSB recommendations and advance the new fatigue management program. Of course, this budget expands service with the full fiscal year of operation of the Silver Line, and as Richard told us this fall, this will turn even greater attention to customer service delivery. I would like to thank Richard and Carol and her team for the advanced preparation work and meetings held at the JCC, as well as the time and attention on responding to our questions in advance. Before we hear from Richard and Carol on the budget, we do have two action items. Today, Jack Rico is requesting an amendment to provide bus service funded by the state of Maryland, and our Chief Human Resources Officer, Tanya Moore McGee, is requesting able to modify the WMATA Deferred Compensation Plan and Trust. Also, in the interest of time, because we do have a packed agenda today, rather than asking staff to provide a presentation, and unless there are any questions or objections to that, I would like just to treat these items to approve. So, could I ask for a motion to approve the budget amendment to provide bus service funded by the state of Maryland? Moved by Ms. Hines, second by Ms. Hampshire Cowan. Any questions for staff? No? Okay. I'll call it. All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? The motion passes. The matter passes. Second half, we also have the approval of the restated WMATA Deferred Compensation Plan. I took this out of order, I'm sorry. Entertain a motion. So move by Ms. Hines? Yes. Yes, you can. I'll entertain a second. Second by Ms. Hines.
Okay. Oh, I thought you were moving the motion. I'm sorry. Is it okay?
Yes, go ahead.
All right, so this will mark the sixth pension program we're going to have.
I'm sorry.
All right, we already have five trustees for five pensions, right? So now we're going to have a sixth one?
Trustee group for the 457 plan.
So it'll be six?
Yes.
So we're proliferating trustees like crazy. How can't coordinate these in a, or husband them, as I've talked to my financial advisors, in terms of investment portfolios and getting reduced basis points, as opposed to six different investment portfolios?
So we're addressing that on two fronts. In terms of the trustees, we are taking an approach where we will be hiring one or two people who are trustees for all five and now six plans. So that'll be the same person from the management representative to be on trustee plans. That's very different than we have now. We have actually existing employees who are doing their day jobs and then acting as trustee part-time to fulfill the obligation for the trust. Doesn't work very well. We need subject matter expert in those areas, and so that'll work great. On the second point, the trustees, in terms of consolidating the trusts, we would have to work with the trustees, the established trustees, in order to consolidate to one trust. So we have to have management's agreement as well as labor's agreement to represent the trustees on their plan. And so we're working to do that.
Great.
It's just that takes a bit of time and probably negotiations with those trustees so that we can actually meet some of the streamlining that you recommended, you know, in terms of fees and things like that. In January, we'll be coming forward with a broader plan on some January to the general manager and currently and then ultimately to the board with a broader plan that talks about some of the revisions and recommendations that we make further to some of those plans.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just think that's great, Carol, that we're focusing on. I think we're, I don't know how we can make a motion or a directive or suggestion that the finances be husband or whatever collectively pulled together so that we can get more oomph out of our investment portfolios, to thereby reducing our potentially, Mr. Chairman, the board's contribution to these retirement programs.
Question?
Sure.
In terms of the structure of this is a 457, right? This is employee voluntary contributions. The employees get to choose from a variety of products?
Yes, they do.
Yes, so it's a standard menu. If you want to be risk averse, you can do this. If you want to
roll
on pork belly futures, you could do that.
That's
but
correct.
Your overall advisor would validate those particular estimates.
Correct.
And then the employee would choose.
Correct.
Got it. Thank you. And the risk is all assumed by the employee.
That is correct.
But,
with respect to Mr. Drew's question, perhaps we could come back maybe a couple board meetings from now or committee meetings from now to maybe talk more about the issue that he raised.
One other comment,
sure.
Maybe this could help with the, maybe Tanya can address it as well. The trust that Ms. McGee is recommending here is not to set investment rates and discount rates for the plan. As Mr. Downey indicated, the plan is managed by now Lincoln, and that the employee who volunteers for this will get advice and counsel from that advisor. The trust that Ms. McGee's recommending is really just to monitor the new adjustment in this plan, which allows our employees to take contributions from that early. And without to IRS regulations and things like that. So that's really the, I'm speaking for you, Ms. McGee, I apologize.
Okay.
But that's really it's not a full-blown trust that will have a lot of the fees associated with other trusts. So does that help?
Just mention that I made a recommendation, Mr. Chairman, that we get input on these at the board level, okay, which we're not getting right now. So, I mean, we have no idea how pension funds are doing. All right, so let's put that on the recommendation.
Okay, so we could be an informational session or presentation kind of going through the universe of plans that we have out there, so have people have a better idea of what exists. the differences that may be, that may exist between them, and maybe we could have a fuller discussion about those at some point in time. So I think a lot of it is just understanding what's out there and kind of what we need to, for the board to have a better idea of what the differences are and kind of what we can do collectively to deal with them.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, I'll call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Next up is the FY 2015 proposed budget and budget hearing authorizations. Before we begin, I would like to maybe perhaps set some ground rules for discussion because we have a lot of things to talk about today, and I know there's a lot of information in the presentation. What I would propose that we do is Mr. Sarles is going to give a general overview of the budget. Ms. Kissel and her staff will then go into the numbers. I would, at some point, there's going to be a discussion of the capital budget. At that point, I will stop the discussion or the presentation so we can focus on any questions that you might have regarding the capital budget as proposed. After that, we'll move forward with the operating budget. Today's key action is really to consider a resolution for public hearings regarding any potential changes. So that's really the work of the board today. Also, I'll note that we have in January and February the opportunity to discuss your questions. And I do believe there's some issues that require deep discussion, prior to consideration of the final budget. So we can take that up in January and February. For those questions, issues that cannot be resolved today, because of the complexity of the issues or we need more information or whatnot, we'll have staff list them on the sheet up front, and then we'll use that to set forth an agenda for the upcoming two board meetings. So we'll make sure your questions are addressed. We'll have time to consider them before we have any we pick up a vote on the budget itself later in the spring. So that's the way I'd like to set it up because we do, again, have a lot to discuss. Also before you, I know that you received this late last night. I've asked staff to give you a hard copy of the resolution. And also for the public, there are additional options that board members have requested for consideration in terms of the fair docket that will be put forward for the hearing. So that information is available to the board members as well as to the public. And we'll be taking those matters up option by option to allow us to have a fuller discussion of those as part of the consideration of the fair resolution. So with that, I'd like to invite to Mr. Sarles to present the general manager's budget.
Today is another day, another step along the way in developing the budget for FY15. We've already, in the previous months, had presentations on preliminary numbers. Today I'm presenting the general manager's budget, but again, that is subject to the need for a lot of public input, which the next couple months will be devoted to that. And after you have received all that input, then the board will have the opportunity to adopt the budget for FY15 sometime in the spring of 2014. So today I'm pleased to present the budget to you for 2015, the proposed budget. It consists of $1.7 billion for operating and $1.1 billion for capital. This proposal continues our fiscal on a safer, more reliable, and better experience for our customers, including a down payment on Momentum. Work continues in FY2015 on the NTSB investments to accomplish critical work, including replacement of track circuits and power cables, among other things. Very soon, after the holidays, the first 7,000 series cars are showing up on the property. We have a contract today for 528 cars. 128 of those are for the Silver Line extension, phase 1 and 2. 300 cars to replace the 1,000 series cars, which, of course, is one of the major recommendations of the NTSB and a significant cost for us. And then 100 cars to replace the 4,000 series cars. With regard to the Silver Line, testing continues on the Silver Line. We have in this budget the first full year of operation of the Silver Line. We have talked to you before about our station lighting program. We've already started that. You see the evidence of that. Customers see evidence of that. In FY15, we expect to see 19 more mezzanines have lighting improvements. The board earlier this year adopted Momentum as a strategic plan. One of the major components of this was to meet the maintenance on the rail system over the next 10, 12 years. And one of the major aspects of this is to go to 8-car trains throughout the system. We have to start making the down payment on that. In the contract that I just mentioned, there is provision for 220 cars, additional cars, which would go quite a way towards providing 8-car trains, but not all the way. While that option does not have to be exercised in FY15, it does have to be exercised in the very beginning of FY16, so we're not very far away from that. In order to get ready for that, as we've talked before, we have to provide maintenance and storage facilities and, very importantly, improve the traction power capacity of the system to get ready for it. So we have to begin work on this if we want to meet the schedule that we've laid out in our strategic plan. Part and parcel of that is looking at our major transfer stations and improvements that have to be made there, and we've talked about that during the strategic planning process. What we would envision is beginning the work on the station, Gallery Place, L'Enfant Station, Metro Center, Farragut West, and McPherson Square, and have all those completed by 2020. But we have to begin the engineering work. In fact, some of the engineering work is already underway. And then there are other stations to follow this part of the plan. We've talked about how the bus priority corridor network supports the regional growth outside of the areas served by the rail system. We should begin to make bus priority corridor improvements, both traffic priority as well as additional buses to support that and to support our existing operations. The first funding for that is included in this budget. I've already talked about the NTSB recommendations, but beyond that, we continue to work on improving our safety culture. We've launched a pilot close call program, and we're in the process of developing the management fatigue risk program. We'll be reporting back to the Security and Safety Committee in January on the progress on that. As the chair mentioned earlier, we are continue to emphasize our focus on customers. Lynn will brief the Customer Service Committee this afternoon about that program, so I won't go into it here. But again, it's to improve service for our customers. Basic program still remains to, it's still about making, we have higher on-time performance for our buses, better rail time, on-time performance, improving our escalator availability, and achieving a higher satisfaction score. A number of the areas that I've laid out before in the business plan, you have in the strategic plan, and I mentioned earlier, address getting to a better quality ride for our customers. You know, many of the initiatives that I've spoken about already serve to connect communities with new rail and bus service. Again, that's part of where we start out with this budget. In order to accomplish everything I've talked about up to this point, requires continued investment in our employees, including the items listed here, such as improving employee engagement. We've already done that in terms of surveys and taking action items from that to improve employee engagement. Succession plan, we started down that road. We're realigning job functions and modernizing job descriptions to meet current resource needs. While we talk about momentum and investing in improved capacity for the rail system and the bus system, we still must continue our rebuild program. That continues unabated and still remains our top priority so that we reach a repair. As we said a number of times before, we're about midpoint in digging out of the hole that we are in. We're expecting about 3 years or so to reach the point where we have a steady state of good maintenance, but even after that, we still need to do the reconstruction and rehabilitation. So when you look at our capital program for the next 6 years, it's an $8 billion program. A little over $5 billion of that is for our program, state of good repair, safety,
The remaining $2.9 billion is for Metro 2025. And in terms of FY15, we look at a total program of $1.1 billion. About $950 million of that is for the base program. The remainder is for Metro 2025. Up to this point, up to and in FY14, our capital program over the last few years has been devoted almost exclusively to the base program of State of Good Repair and Safety, well over 90% of the capital program. That ratio changes as we move forward here. In the next six-year program, about two-thirds of it is devoted to the base, and about a third of it is devoted to Metro 2025. In FY15, about 83% is devoted to the State of Good Repair and 17% to Metro 2025. But the important thing, again, I keep reemphasizing it, this change in ratio is not achieved by cutting back on the base program. It's achieved by adding to the base program. When we look at the investment sources needed for this, what we basically assume over the next several years is the federal program will continue at its current level. We see about, FY15, about $460 million coming from federal sources, about $350 million from state sources, and about $150 million for Metro 2025 increase that I talked about. And there's also set aside for finance, about $110 million. So just reconfirm Metro 2025, $2.9 billion over the next half a dozen years to advance Metro 2025. A total of $6.5 billion out of Metro 25. And this really represents a summary of capital expenditures to execute the strategic plan adopted with regard to Metro 2025. So at this point, as the chair mentioned, I'll take any questions on the capital program, and then we can turn to Carol to talk about the operating and revenue side.
Thank you, Mr. Searles. Are there any questions regarding the capital budget as presented?
Ms. Hines? Mr. Costa, thank you very much. Mr. Searles, thank you for laying this out. And there, you know, we've all been working to get ourselves to this point of understanding what it will take for the region to step into what is an aggressive and bold vision, I think, for 2025, and yet absolutely necessary if the system's going to keep serving the people of this region well. As I have come to understand this a little bit more deeply from my jurisdictional viewpoint, we are facing, I think, as a region, some real challenges fiscally at the local level, too. And each of our stories is slightly different, but these are not easy times to be in local government and to be dealing with funding of this magnitude. So I just want to make sure that I understand what's here and that the community understands what's here, and then ask potentially for some additional work to happen before we get to the end. So right now, as I understand it, the local jurisdictions, to me, that's sort of generically our key local funding partners, we wear different hats and different names, are putting in about $200 million a year into the capital program. And this step up into 2015 presumed an additional about $150 million coming from those same sources. Is that's correct? I see head nods. Okay. So just that was the interesting context for me that I hadn't understood until relatively recently. So for most of us who are local funders, it means we have to double what we're doing, which is pretty dramatic, honestly. And I know there's a variety of different things going on, both Maryland and Richmond. Annapolis and Richmond put more money on the table, but we're still shaking all of that out, and it's not clear how it's going to play in next year's budget at all. And many of us are on a two-year CIP cycle in our jurisdictions, and so that's going to happen in the spring, probably after we adopt this budget. So I want to be absolutely clear. I am not suggesting any sort of backing away from the commitments here. But I know in the conversations I've had in my jurisdictions and some I've had with others, we probably need to understand better what our choices are inside this ask. In that, and we need to have some options before us that allow us to operate at different levels of affordability in terms of this capital commitment. And it also goes to the issue which follows this one, which has to do with, it's a proposal for how Virginia's new regional money could play, but actually has potential to be a broader policy about bringing additional dollars to bear through a variety of tools that also could help us, not in 2015 necessarily, but as we move forward. So I guess that's a sort of a long statement to say I think we're going to need some options. I know our staff is absolutely willing to dig into this and work collaboratively with Metro staff, but speaking now, just wearing my jurisdictional hat, it will be very difficult for me to be able to bring all that money to bear as an increase in one single year from Arlington.
Sure. And I appreciate that. I certainly heard that in my discussions as I've gone among the three jurisdictions. And I think the way to pursue that is that the jurisdictions think about what they can afford, given all the parties they have to deal with. And at the same time, we can work with the jurisdictions to say, okay, these are the areas that could move forward. These things might have to stretch out some so that we can come up with a couple, two, three steps for the board to make policy decisions as to how they want to proceed, never sacrificing the scope of the work, but really the timing of the work. And also, a lot of it depends on the jurisdictions, especially in the bus area, when they can, you know, make things happen also. So I think that all can be pulled together into two, three scenarios, as long as the jurisdictions will give us an idea of what they want to look at in terms of revenue flow. And, of course, there are other financing options, too, that could help spread that out. But I would see that Carol and Rob would lead the effort with the jurisdictions to do that. And I know that we've talked a little bit about, you know, getting other thoughts, and I've asked Sham and Carol to come up with some ideas based on what you have suggested about alternatives of, you know, funding, financing that may be out of the box, to work with other leaders throughout the region to do that.
So is this something that we can bring forward in terms of the scenarios to the January or February committee meeting?
I think that there should be
discussion.
We should start it out, the discussions, and then report back forward how we're doing. And it could be January, it could be February. Okay. There'll probably be a few reports on this.
Okay.
January is pretty quick, right. Quite honestly, given the holidays.
So perhaps we can do this in February. But why don't we add that to the list of issues? So this would be scenarios for Metro 2025 capital.
Mr. Costa, could I just make one other observation? And I appreciate Rich saying, you know, there's the base and there's Metro 2025. But from our funding point of view, there's no difference, right? And Metro 2025, if we're committed to it, has to just be in the CIP.
I absolutely agree with you. It's part of that plan. And the only reason I've been making that distinction is what I said earlier. I don't want to see the base shrink at the expense of adding it, because then you get into a problem we had years ago here.
Okay. We had, I think, Ms. Porter, Ms. Downey, Ms. Hudgens, Mr. Downey. Okay.
I want to agree with Mrs. Hines on the importance of doing that. The thing that I think would be very helpful would be to have the JCC involved in developing those scenarios, because they have the better sense of, you know, where the money is coming from and what pace it comes at. And I think, excuse me, putting together those scenarios, I'd really like to see them heavily involved in that process.
Absolutely.
Mr. Downs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In July of this year, the GAO released a report titled roughly Transit Agency Management of Capital Investments. They reviewed nine agencies, one of which was WMATA. It says, for us. The authority examines the condition of its rail and bus assets and collects asset condition information. Agency officials told us that they use track walkers that inspect the track price on a weekly basis. However, the agency currently is not able to determine the effect of capital investment decisions on the condition of its assets because the agency does not link changes or differences that occur as a result of capital investment. They point out later in a summary decision that this means that none of the nine transit agencies have a sophisticated way of measuring the immediate-term and long-term impacts of capital investment. I think it's worth having a response to that as part of the capital budget proposal going forward. And if there are necessary costs to get to that level of linkage about the capital investments that we're making, that we should be making, we should start that set of investments with this budget to develop the capacity to deliver that out-year performance.
What we're talking about here is transit asset management strategies. We already have under development that. In fact, I think a little advance of the FTA. If Rob, you want to talk about a couple of, for a minute or two, of what we're doing to advance transit asset management.
Absolutely. We have a number of initiatives underway, and specifically addressing the needs of capital investment to the track conditions. I think what's notable is our track geometry vehicle, which, you know, is a investment made under the capital program. We're able to collect information from the track geometry vehicle. That information is then inputted to a ProTran system, and we can actually do analysis based on this ProTran system that can be predictive and also an asset, truly asset-based on condition. In other words, you know, when we're looking at where on, say, the low rail side on a curve that's elevated, you know, we generally replace the rail on a time-based condition. Right now what we're able to do is we're able to replace it on what is truly an asset condition. So we're maximizing, you know, our capital dollars on that. So I think from an asset management standpoint, we are moving certainly to be able to make those predictive analysis, be able to create an environment where we're efficiently expending our funds. Additionally, on the rail cars, we're going to a mileage asset-based. You know, right now we're on a time-based condition, but you know, what we're doing is we're able to capture information from the car itself as it comes to the yard based on mileage. That automatically produces work orders based on the mileage of the thing, which is, again, more to actually condition assessment to be able to replace it, which maximizes our dollars. All of our assets are getting inputted now into an asset management database, which, you know, collect that information, and we have a lot of those mechanisms in place now to automatically generate the work orders or to provide feedback to us on the conditions. So I do take some exception to the fact that they would indicate that we don't have, you know, an opportunity or means or methods to be able to, you know, indicate what our track conditions are and the effect of the capital investments on that. And again, we are setting up an asset management group as part of the FY15 budget. That's included in there so that we have a comprehensive agency authority-wide asset management group that will be focused on these specific things. So we absolutely are moving in that direction.
And if you'd like, we can come back to committee and give you a briefing on that.
Could I also suggest, though, that when you get a GAO report for draft and comment, that it is appropriate to do detailed comments or it won't wind up in the report. Just to read the last line of the one of the summary pieces, none of the reviewed transit agency measured the effects of capital investment decisions on future ridership, partly because they lacked tools that can assess the sophisticated relationship between capital investments and future ridership. They say none of the authorities that they reviewed can make a linkage about future ridership impact of their capital investments in state of good repair. That's something I think if we're going to justify that out-year set of capital commitments going forward, we have to be able to explain to our customers and to our regional stakeholders what that future ridership impact is. It's not an unreasonable criticism or a suggestion, and I hope that we can have more discussion about that going forward.
Thank you, Mr. Downs. Mrs. Hudgens and Mr. Downing.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sarles and staff for coming forward with this budget. And I think the discussion here is, as we're here at the head of Mr. Downs' comment and Ms. Hines, is really a historic moment for us, because I think this is putting us where we set in momentum on what has not occurred in this authority before. And I think we all should recognize that, and that is a commitment that we not only will maintain a steady repair, but we will plan our growth forward for the region. I think this point is a well-taken one, and I would only add to it that as you bring back those scenarios, you bring them back across all of our funding parts, because I think it is very important to be explicit that all of us are holding hands and committing to this, and that the return on investment is to all and everyone that shares in the commitment to Metro, and that it is outlined clearly.
I think that's an excellent point. All the funding partners here have to come to the table and be part of this conversation. Otherwise, we might never get to a conclusion.
Yes. Mr. Gavin.
Well, as one of the funding partners, I'd like to make a comment about federal money. If you could put the chart back up for CIP fund. Yeah, that's good. And I would make the point, none of the three of us sitting here are decision makers. The decision makers sit up on Capitol Hill or at the OMB. So. Very important in that case. What's assumed in here, as I understand it, is essentially a flat program over the six-year period. There's also a feature that our fiscal year lags the federal fiscal year by one. So we go with money in hand before we actually do the first-year budget. So the first year you see up there, 2015, is the receipt of federal money for 2014, which is the year now in, which is an appropriation bill that has yet to pass. But we hope within the next few weeks we get some sense of what will occur in that year. Each year thereafter, our 16, 17, 18, 19, 20 is part of a future reauthorization bill. We don't know when that will happen, but it should begin to happen in the next few months. We'll get a sense of where it's going. We also have the so-called PREA funds, which were authorized in the Rail Act. Those, as I understand it, will run through fiscal 20. Our fiscal 20, they run to federal fiscal 19. So there's some certainty. But the point I wanted to make is to assume anything other than a flat program, which in itself, given the 535 decision makers, is a significant assumption. You have to figure out how the rules of the game would change. The funding that we now receive from the federal government is largely formula-driven. So either the formula would have to change or the total amount would have to change to generate any new money. The rest of it is the special allocation under PREA. Both of those sources, and especially the latter, are very much focused on state of good repair. The formula is literally in a program called State of Good Repair. The receipt of PREA money, which is actually a discretionary act on the part of the Federal Transit Administration, are driven by, are we doing what we need to be doing in a state of good repair? So when the CEO talks about that as a priority, that is also the federal priority. So we cannot consider dipping into that to finance 2025. So is there a way of federal support for 2025? Difficult, but at least should be considered on the table. As reauthorization is being considered, one of the proposals that was actually enacted but not funded in MAP 21 is federal support for core capacity improvements that actually allow larger numbers of people. There's no money for it. Hopefully in the reauthorization bill, there will be some money identified. We would still have to compete for that. Competition will be very strong. Chicago is already at the starting line with a couple of their projects, which have now been qualified to go forward in the engineering process. And in the competition, one of the first things you hear about this region, you already have a special source. You're coming for another one, but nothing to prevent that. But I would make the point that if we have all talked about momentum, talked about Metro 2025, talked about the importance of those investments, we're now at the point of reality that they do have to be paid for, and there may be a way to strategize additional federal support, but don't consider that it's an easy or a simple outcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Denny. And Mrs. Hines.
Thanks. Could you go to the next slide, the one there? So as we're thinking about how to convey to the public that we are still building the funding plan for this, it may be that putting a line under here that says something like this is currently unfunded, but we're looking for new or additional funding from all potential sources, including federal, state, and local, just kind of reminds everybody who looks at it that this is a work in progress and it's a region in progress. So I would suggest we think about some language like that that would go with this chart every time we put it out.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, we'll move on to the operating budget. Ms. Kissel.
Mr. Sorrells. So before we move into the funding aspect of the operating budget, I just wanted to take a moment and talk about what we do every time we put together an operating budget. We actually look at, it's an ongoing practice that we have to look at efficiencies and effectiveness. And it's just, I wanted to highlight a couple of things here. You know, increasing effectiveness allows us to improve the quality of the service we provide, not only to our internal customers in the administrative support area, but actually it also impacts our external customers to some extent as well. So it's something of importance to us. And then the efficiency allows us to identify efficiencies in those administrative support areas. So I just wanted to highlight a couple here. The long-term cost in the pension health care, maybe the point that Mr. Bolger was bringing up earlier, I think that the most significant accomplishment that we have already made is the slowdown of the contributions in the pension area because of the employee participation of pension contributions with the majority amount of our employees. And this has actually been will help slow the curve of our pension contributions, employer contributions, currently down quite a bit. And you see that when I show some of the numbers on that area. Additionally, I've mentioned this before, our health care costs are actually behind the national average in terms of growth. They're still growing. You'll see that in the budget numbers, but not as at a rate that's at the pace at the national average. The wellness program that we've had in the FY15 budget, we will start to see benefits of that, not necessarily as much in FY15, but mostly in FY16 and beyond. And that's one of the initiatives in the FY15 budget. In terms of the other areas that we have found some efficiencies are on total cost of fleet initiatives. This area is focused primarily on non-revenue fleet. And the approach that we took when we looked at our non-revenue fleet, which you can imagine is quite large because we have a large footprint in the region where we're actually using our non-revenue fleet, we looked at a total cost of ownership. And so we did an analysis that looked at how we can standardize our fleet, how we can take into consideration fit for purpose in terms of how we buy fleet for what the use is. And then we also took a look at some of the modern technologies in the fleet. All of those have resulted and are resulting in a reduction not only in the fleet cost from the capital side, but are reducing the maintenance costs associated with those fleets. So those are good programs that we put in place as well. And on the procurement inventory control side, we actually have instituted from the prior year supply chain initiatives. This basically is just a continuation of aligning demand with our supply. As you'll see in the budget, we have increased our materials and supplies costs, That is only because we are finally aligning what our use is based upon all of the increases that we had on terms of rehabbing of our fleet, some of our maintenance issues that we've had on some of the fleet, and some of the materials and supplies that we need in order to support that. So you'll see a rise and increase on the materials and supplies, but on the other side of it, you'll see some efficiencies associated with supply chain that are looking at using the materials that we have on the shelf, reducing the order quantity points, so we're buying what we need, more just-in-time types of activities. So that's ongoing as well. The garage lighting project, we have initiated a contract with that last month to take 25 of our garages and improving the lighting. It's a real benefit for customers in terms of appearance and from a safety perspective. But it's actually also a great cost savings. The LED cost savings that we have in the energy efficiency will be used to fund the investment on that program. So that's a great innovative way in order to find capital money to make an investment that benefits our customers and provides a safe environment in that area. And then finally, on the workforce planning side, we're doing a lot of this work in my area, actually. And so we're championing this in many ways. It's looking at increasing capabilities of our workforce in terms of providing value-add analysis with associated with our business operations, rail and bus. We're looking at modifying and streamlining things that we do now and modernizing. For example, streamlining using electronic automation to pay invoices, do procurement activities and things like that. All of those streamlining efforts using automation and modernizing it do two things. It actually increases the level of your workforce in terms of what they do because they're doing more value-add analysis, and it lowers the amount of transaction time associated with things. And at the end of the day, all of those types of things improve cycle time, improve the cost of your operations quite a bit. So those are just a couple of main highlights I wanted to show you that we do on a regular basis to look at efficiencies and effectiveness when we build a budget. So going to the next page, the numbers page, I'll talk about this in segments. Let me talk a little bit about revenue here. I'll get to the expense side, and then we'll go a little bit more on revenue when I talk later on in the presentation about the general manager's proposed revenue adjustments, fare increases that we're proposing. So first of all, on the revenue side, you see the increase. This is a budget to budget comparison, the budget that we're in here this year to the budget that the general manager is proposing in FY15. You see the increase in revenue of $60 million. Primarily, about half of that is associated with the general manager's recommendation that you will review on fare increases. The other part of that, about $17 million, is due to a full year of our new line, Silver Line. And then there's another part of it of $9 or so million that's associated with just what we call organic ridership increase and growth in our ridership base. The growth, and Mark talked about this a little bit last month, we have about, we're assuming about a little bit less than 1% on rail in terms of organic ridership growth on that, and we're assuming about a 3% on bus, or 2%, and organic ridership on bus. And both of those are very, when Mark does his economic analysis on ridership, and I'll talk about this a little bit later, we take a lot of things into consideration when we develop these revenue projections. And we tend to be a little conservative because we want to make sure that we highlight events that are occur that we don't plan for. And I'll talk about those later, weather and things like that. Turning over to the expense side, the salaries and wages that you see there are primarily associated with the positive wage settlements that we've made with our union workforce, and you'll see the increase there is primarily associated with that. We have no real increase in headcount from year from this budget to next year. Actually, we have zero increase in headcount on the operating side. So that dollar amount is primarily wages. The pension increase, I'll talk a little bit about that. That is actually, in 5 years I have been here, that has been the lowest increase in our pension change year to year. That's a good news story on two fronts. The one I mentioned earlier, that in FY15, We have now a large majority of our workforce that is planning for their retirement and contributing to that, which is a very positive step. The second benefit that we're getting here is the market performance. We've suffered over the last several years of poor market performance, and it has carried through in the last couple of years because, as you remember, we've had to amortize some of those losses over that time frame. We're sort of peeking out of that now, and as a result, we're actually seeing much better market performance with regards to the pensions. In terms of health and other benefits, the increase there are attributable to some of it is attributable to the salary, wages, settlements that we make. We have to increase FICA and things like that that are associated with that. The other is an organic increase in health care costs that we naturally would get as a result of that. And then the main increase here is about $4 million that's associated with the recommendation that the general manager is making to pre-fund the OPEB benefit or the OPEB fund that we have at Metro, which is retiree health care that we are obligated to pay. It's a large number on our balance sheet, and we have never funded that trust. And the recommendation that we're making here is that we should start to pre-fund that. We're starting at a very small dollar amount, and we hope to make that larger as we go along. There's a couple of benefits. One is the more we adopt a pre-funding approach, the better they will be able to earn the investment returns that are required, and then they'll meet the payout obligations that we have in the future. It may not meet the term. It might take quite a while. But the fact is that our contribution to that on a regular basis will be lower. And then the second piece, we are really matching what our peer jurisdictions do. Most of the jurisdictions that fund us do a pre-fund of retiree health care. So we're recommending that in our budget. In terms of the non-personnel costs, the small amount of increase that you see there, the $11 million, it's really attributable to some of the initiatives that we have in our operating plan, budget FY15, and primarily some of the realignment that we have been talking about over the last couple of months. We have increased materials and supplies budget to reflect our actual spend so that we wanted to realign that. We'll reset a few other things. We have a close call program that we are now putting in place, as Mr. Sorrells indicated, and that accommodates for a few million dollars. We have material supplies realignment, and then we just have the natural organic increase in maintenance leases associated with leases that we have, that we maintain, equipment leases and such. So that's pretty much a very small or a brief snapshot of the increases in terms of the year-to-year, and we're happy to go into detail if you have any questions, and I know we'll provide in the detail when we give you the total budget. At the end of the day, you see the gross subsidy increase, and on the next chart, I think we talk about that, and that's right there. You'll see that the subsidy increase for our jurisdictions, based on the revenue projections that we have and the fair proposal increases that we have, we're anticipating that that subsidy contribution will increase by about 6%. The structure of the allocation of the subsidy is going to remain the same, and what that means is how it's allocated will remain the same. We're not modifying the formula for any reason. We will have to maybe modify that when phase two of Silver Line comes into place. We have new stations and things like that, but right now we're staying with the allocation that we have. Let me go to the next page. So let's talk a little bit about revenue opportunities here. One of the, besides passenger revenue and parking revenue, we also have revenue associated with digital advertising that contributes to our budget. And I'll talk about that second bullet first and then go to the top. So we're in the process of recontracting for our advertising budget. As you know, when we had the advertising contract 5 years ago, it was a very good contract. The recession hit us. We actually had to renegotiate another contract during that time period, and as a result, we did a contract that really just associated itself with static advertising. We have a great opportunity here. I know Lynn Bowersox is leading the effort to revise the advertising contract, and we'll have that in place sometime next year. She's looking to do more digital advertising and more dynamic types of advertising, and as a result, I think we'll see a slight increase in some of the revenue associated with the advertising contracts. In terms of the first, we're looking to develop, we have a pilot program in place now, actually, on past products for SMART benefits. Right now, the way a federal employee receives SMART benefits is through their employer, and it gets put onto their card, their SMART trip card, through a card-based program. And what we're recommending here is a pass product for the federal workers or any worker who has full access to SMART benefits. The price is what the monthly price will be that we have on our currently in terms of the pass product. And we're rolling that out now. We're going to see how many people take advantage of that particular product. And then based upon the technical feasibility, as well as how many people are, how much demand we have for the product, we'll decide to either roll it in our FY15 program, and then we'll have some revenue projections modified to associate that. Talk about that after January and February. So let's go to the proposed fare changes that we have.
Chairman, could we stop for now and sure. Talk about expenses?
Okay. Why don't we do that before we get into the discussion? Actually, Mr. Dean Cole had a question, then we'll take it from Mr. Downey.
Thank you. Thank you for the briefing so far. Two questions. You did mention that there was no anticipated increase in headcount or FTEs.
Yes.
Yet I see certainly a ramping up still of the construction program. I see phase two of the Silver Line coming,
yes.
And I'm assuming that we've already met our obligations as far as numbers and hires for phase one.
Yes.
Explain where that fits in, particularly since you're saying there's no headcount increase.
So all of our headcount and workforce associated with the line expansion for Silver Line is already in place in this year's budget. So we're ready to go. For the capital program for FY15, as you see, we are ramping up. And there are associated headcount increases that are associated in the capital program, not the operating. So it might be 187 workforce. They're force account labor. We report that on a regular basis, and that will be in the budget book that you receive. Each capital project will have a description. It will have a schedule, it will have milestones, it will have expenses, it will have the labor and the force account associated with that capital project. So you'll see that in the detail.
Okay. Second question, and my last question, on I guess it's the page where you had the proposed operating budget. And I know I've asked this question previously, but you have a preventative maintenance line as a negative. Does this mean we actually didn't spend all that money, or we haven't met our obligations of the work we were expected to do in preventative maintenance?
No.
Outline what that really means.
It's what it means is it we actually use our formula, $31 million of our formula money, capital money, federal money to apply it to our operating budget for preventative maintenance activities that are current our operating budget. That's not to say that our preventative maintenance activities are $30 million. They're probably north of $500 million, I'm sure.
Right.
But that portion of it is associated with that. So.
But it really kind of relates to the next related areas. You know, have we met all of our preventative maintenance requirements for the current year, or are we on track? In other words, we've outlined for the full year what we hope to do in preventative maintenance. Have we met those requirements, or have we been deficient in some, et cetera, et cetera?
Now, we've met our requirements for our preventative maintenance in all the larger items, you know, through the TIES organization, the transit infrastructure, the rail cars. I don't see any issues, you know, with where we are there.
Mr. Denning?
Just following up on preventive maintenance, most of you weren't on the board the last time we did this, but it was beginning to head towards using more and more of our federal capital to do that. This was reversed. Someday I would like to turn that 31 to zero, especially when we have so many capital needs, but probably not the year to that, but just flag that point. Three quick questions. On the pension side, we are still maintaining an employer contribution, correct? Even though the market has improved, we're not going to make the mistake of the past and begin to back out employer contributions.
No, we have a maintenance contract. Yep. Yes,
right.
That's correct.
Right, okay. Materials, mm-hmm. Within our structure, when does the material cost hit budget? Is it the point when it's purchased or the point when it's used?
The point when it's used.
Used. So the fact that we're using more means that's stuff that's actually being put to work.
Yeah, it's
you don't see what's happening with inventory except on the balance sheet. But,
that's correct.
Yeah, but
that's
this
correct.
Isn't. We're just buying a lot of things to store in the storerooms. We're actually right. putting them out there on the cars and the buses. Okay,
and that's yeah. a great point. I might yeah. add the part of the efficiency efforts that I know Rob's groups are doing is using more things that are on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
So versus that's the demand supply alignment,
right.
and so that helps the balance sheet, and it also helps the efficiency.
And once we get the balance sheet under control, we could go to more of a just-in-time approach to deliver the equipment when we need them.
Yes, we
yeah.
we
okay.
definitely could.
Yeah. A third quick question on the PASS program with the smart benefit.
Yes.
I assume you will get an IRS reading on whether that's legitimate. The PASS program, for example, allowed work trips and non-work trips. I don't think IRS would qualify that.
We could do that. I know
yeah.
we have gotten an IRS we have gotten an IRS qualifier for the separation of the benefits.
Right. But today it's pretty good because it's trip by trip,
right.
and I think we'll get some pushback on.
Yeah.
on that, if it's giving
we will approach them.
That has lots of differences beyond
yeah.
the work trip.
I think the last time we did approach them, they were a little reluctant to be specific in the request that we made, but we will approach them.
IRS is always reluctant to be specific.
Yes, I noticed that.
Get very, very specific after you've done it.
Okay. So we will note that.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Dan. Mr. Golden.
I think I know the answer, but the reason for the higher percentage change for the district in terms of providing subsidy is?
Oh, it's I'm not guessing.
I think one of the primary reasons is the non-regional bus. As we've talked in previous meetings, non-regional bus has not had the ridership growth that the regional bus has, and so what you have is a situation where the costs for non-bus have gone up and the revenues have gone down. The district
wasn't the school subsidy.
No, the school subsidy is included separately.
Okay.
I am going to be working over the next week or so with all the JCC staff to go into the subsidy calculations in a little more detail and answer any of those sorts of detailed questions about exactly where is the growth coming from.
Good. Second, on pensions, pension costs are roughly 10% of our operating budget. I think it warrants a separate item in the budget that can track over time the cumulative effect on an annual basis of the employee contributions as well as the authority contributions, that it tracks in that budget account the changes in the unfunded liability on a year-to-year basis, as we're calculating it both on the five-year smoothing and on the one-year current valuation of the fund. It is too important an item for us to not have a specific focus on it instead of it having it buried within either HR or the personnel budget. I think it needs a freestanding account page that can give the board more information about the management of that account. The third is we're not to it yet, but there are a set of assumptions about revenues about a bus increase. It is about 9.5%. I'm not going to speak to the issue itself in terms of revenue. I have a hard time understanding a rationale that could be acceptable to our customers about why it's 3% for rail and 9.5% for bus. We've kind of discounted the fact that bus ridership, one of the reasons maybe the bus ridership is growing, well, it's also growing in terms of its revenue. Not a lot, but growing. The other is that elasticities are favorable on bus because most riders do not have a choice. Most of them don't have access to a car. They're on this for a reason. So it's not, that's not a legitimate reason for a bus increase of 9.5%. I notice that we now have an argument that says, well, some of our peers have higher bus fares than we do. And the one that I know is the MTA in New York. The bus fare includes a rail ride. So there's a reason why the bus fare in New York is higher. It is not a comparable. It's helpful if we're going to use large system bus fares as a rationale for increasing our bus fares to have an apples-to-apples comparison. But I'm still not sure that that is even an adequate explanation for a 9.5 to, if we modify the docket sum, minus 9.5 to 11.5% increase in bus fares. I know I'm going to sound like an unreconstructed liberal, but the majority of our bus, there are still a few. The majority of our bus riders are low income. They are in jobs. When I'm on the bus, I'm often the only suit on the bus. We have a captive, transit-dependent bus population that the authorities traditionally tried to pay attention to as having a different set of economic needs and dependability and reliability around its bus service that is different than rail. All I'm saying is that if we're going to seriously consider as part of going to hearings, that we have a rationale for 9.5% on a proposed bus increase.
Okay, thank you. We have a discussion on the docket itself and kind of these issues about fares and equity and all these other items that you brought up, which are fair discussion points. But I'd like to focus on the expense side first because that will all get lost in the conversation. So just limit it to that for now, and then we'll go to the docket in a few minutes. So, Mr. Golden, did you have any other questions?
I did have an expense question. thank you for your presentation today, and also thank you for answering the numerous questions that Natalie and myself propounded to you over the last month, and you did provide answers. I want to follow up on one of them, which is related to the chart. The chart shows that total expenses increased $101 million for the proposed FY15 over the existing fiscal year, FY14. In response to those questions and your testimony and presentation this morning, you indicated that about 89 to 90 million of that results from organic increases in cost relating from the labor settlements and increases in sort of non-labor costs, buying fuel or power and things of that nature. So that leaves about 11 to 12 million that's just unaccounted for. And I believe describe that 11 or 12 million as new initiatives for FY15. I would love as a Christmas present if you could give us a schedule that goes through those new initiatives for Hanukkah, well, slate for Hanukkah, but at least for Christmas. But perhaps you could take a few minutes right now to just describe the principle, the biggest one, two, or three of those new initiatives, what they are and how many millions of dollars attached to them.
Yes, I can. We have a pretty big list, but I just tell you, overall, the largest contribution to that $12 million is Priority Corridor Network. And all things associated with the investment that Metro has to make in order to make that happen. It does not include the Priority Corridor Network that Mr. Sarles referenced, obligation on behalf of the jurisdictions that they will have to make in order to make that happen. So that's the majority of that. But there's probably a list of a dozen others that make up smaller Hanukkah presents, I guess.
but the seventh or eighth thing.
Yes. Yes, right. I'll just read a couple.
Can I just stop you there and just focus on the priority card network?
Sure.
How much is attached to that?
On the 12, it's, is it five? Okay, yeah, thank you, Vi. Yeah, okay. So that's five, and that's the major portion of it. The others are, you know, a million or two, and they're less than that. So that's the majority of that. We can get you a full list in detail. In the detail that you'll get in the budget book, you'll have all the details.
Just then, on the five, is the five, I assume the $5 million is not the actual purchase of buses. That would come under capital. So right. This is the actual salaries for operators and fuel.
That's correct.
And those kind of things.
Everything.
And are those priority bus networks assigned as of this point in time as to where they will go, in which jurisdiction or which routes?
No, not yet. Jack?
Let me try to answer that. I mean, we have a list of efforts that we believe are ready to be implemented in FY15 by jurisdiction. And with the process of approving the budget, we'd be working with the jurisdictions as to which improvements we would make with the improved dollars and buses that we could potentially get from this budget proposal.
So the actual use would be a matter of consultation with the jurisdictions.
Absolutely,
over the
right.
Next year.
Right, because we've got to get the operating subsidies to support the additional you know, the assignment, the appropriation by jurisdiction, and also where it can best be used, and work that out with the jurisdictions on an annual basis.
And just one final question. What does $5 million buy you? Does it buy you two bus routes, three bus routes? What are we talking about in
well,
terms
one of the, one of the investments is on Pennsylvania.
For Mr. Downs's bus riders.
One of the investments in the district would be like $1 million on the 30 line to try to improve on-time performance and to meet the demands of the ridership. The K-9 service in Maryland and other routes that we have, I've got a list of those that I'll be talking to the jurisdictions about. We would anticipate, you know, a rather significant increase in ridership as a result of this improved on-time performance also.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr.
I'll just burden Ms. Kissel for asking what the second initiative is. So now we're going down a couple $1 million.
Yeah, there's
right?
a lot of things in terms of that are headed under this, I would call, supply chain inventory control. And supply rail quality inspection for parts and things like that. There's rail de-stressing. I'm just talking about some of the operating side. There's a Metro Bus Customer Ambassador Program, which is sort of a nod towards trying to get more connected to our customers under the program that Lynn Bowersox is heading. Digital recovery training resources. And then there's some ROCC, our Rail Operating Center, service improvements that I know Rob's got on his plate. So.
And they'll all be scheduled in the Christmas present that we'll be receiving.
Yes, in that present.
Mr. Downey, and then I'd like to let the staff up.
Two quick follow-ups. When we're talking about initiatives, I believe some of that's financed not by the $12 million, but by investments shifting around, so they may actually be more. Could you provide us at some point the level of initiatives that had been included in each of the last three budgets, because this is the smallest increment I can recall, but we're still getting the benefit from all the ones that were done in the past.
Right, and we should do, what you just pointed out, that we have been able to self-fund other
a good portion of these initiatives. And just one question or comment on priority bus networks. To my understanding, those will work a lot better if we get support from the jurisdictions for traffic flow improvements and other things. I think as we negotiate with them, that ought to be a quid pro quo. I don't think we should be paying to buy and staff a lot of buses to just send out and get lost in traffic. So hopefully that will be part of the discussion with the jurisdictions.
Mr. Chairman, could I?
Okay. One quick request.
The overtime normalization item has, as Mr. Downey pointed out in one of his emails, a significant amount of trade-offs between issues of full staffing rather than having an 8 or 9% vacancy rate, pension cost, and fatigue and safety issues. And I would suggest that the place to take that issue for a better explanation, because we're trying to manage the overtime from a safety perspective, would be to make a full-scale presentation on this issue to Safety Committee with the chair of the Safety Committee's agreement.
One of my questions is that we ask for this analysis. It's not ready yet, but when it is ready, we're in a good place to discuss it.
Good. At the Safety Committee. Thank you.
Okay. Why don't we finish up our presentation? So, Ms. Kissel.
So fare increases. We'll start with the policy that the board has adopted, and we are abiding by to look at fare increases as measured by inflation by the consumer price index, biannual. So that's sort of the framework that we're using, as well as the guidelines that the board has adopted to simplify fares, make them easy for customers, and ensure that they're equitable and things like that. So under the guidance there, we're looking at proposing that Metro Access remain as the 2x fare structure, which we currently have in place, and that the cap of $7 stays at that same cap. One of the reasons for that is that the fare calculator that we have deployed to help the community of interest there has been doing very well, and has, as you can see in some of the reports I've provided in the past, the average fare has gone down by 20 cents for that community who uses the service, so we're not really recommending any change in that regard. In terms of the bus, to Ms. Tone's point, we are doing two things. We're eliminating the cash surcharge on all routes, but we are also looking to simplify our fares, and although the rationale about our peers is one that we have communicated to be more aligned with our peers, one of the other rationales for the increase that we're recommending here is the fact that we have been absent in looking at moving bus fares along as rail fares have increased. I think that years ago, we probably had one of the first bus increases that we've had in, I want to say, a decade or maybe longer. And so when you bifurcate your modes of transportation that way in terms of price, you end up having a disparity. And the point that you're making is a very, very good one, because it appears that we're increasing, but our recommendation here, by 9%, and rail is now only being recommended increase of 3%. So one of the reasons why we like to look at these on an every two-year basis is so that we don't get out of alignment. So that's a consideration, I think, that was put into place as we looked at the bus fare increase. In terms of the rail, we are looking to – yeah, sorry, on the wrong page. We are looking at the increase for rail at 3%. Let me backstep a little bit. In terms of CPI, we use statistics from the Bureau of Labor Statistics to generate assessments as to where we think CPI is. And basically, two-year CPI in this region has ticked up quite a bit, a little bit, not a lot, but at 4%, I believe. And so there was a range that we're talking about in terms of recommendations for the rail increase on that regard. For parking, we're looking to let me talk about the peak. If you remember the last rail increase that we had capped some customers who ride in the off-peak and peak area because their increase was a lot more than what the recommended average increase was for. So we're looking to still keep that cap in place, but it would just rise slightly. I think it's by 10 cents, if I remember, or probably around that level. You'll see the details in the doc that we recommend. The parking increase, we're recommending a system-wide 25-cent increase. We do have some parking lots, price event parking currently at Morgan Boulevard and at the Largo Town Center, which has never gotten any legs. We don't get a lot of demand there. So I think we have priced it at $25. We're looking to reduce the pricing there to $15 in order to create some more demand associated with those lots. In terms of the net impact of those fare changes, we're looking at a $30 million increase currently with those small changes. We've done some initial Title VI analysis and screening that we have reviewed with the general manager, and the recommendation that you see there falls within the Title VI requirements and standards currently. In terms of budget risks and uncertainty, the items that we have here are pretty much the same risks that we deal with on a yearly basis. Maybe the small change here is the fact that, you know, we have never addressed or never dealt with a sequestration, and now that might be a common thing that we're dealing with. So some of the issues are very, we end up developing a budget and we end up playing through these risks, but it's not without some thought. And so I will say that when we do the ridership and revenue projections in our budget, we tend to be a bit conservative because we know that there's pending events that could happen, and we don't have the authority currently to have a reserve. I think that if we had a reserve, I'm sure the JCC would start pulling that string and saying, you know, let's not do that. So what we end up doing is we end up building it into our budget and trying to accommodate for that. That being said, there's two recent things that I wanted to talk about from our government affairs office that said it appears very unlikely that Congress will not take any action to prevent transit subsidy from going down before the end of the year. So that's a risk that's looming, and we'll have to address that in this year's budget. But for the FY15 budget, we assume the higher levels of transit subsidy. And then the second point I want to make, that it also appears very likely that our PREA funds, this is not an operating, but it's more of a risk issue, that our PREA funds for 2015 will once again be impacted by sequestration. So those things we'll have to deal with in our FY15 budget. As we develop scenarios specifically for the capital suggested, we'll try to bake some of those scenarios in. But that said, I feel comfortable that the mitigation that we have built into the budget will be able to deal with these risks and uncertainty that we live with on a regular basis when we develop the Metro budget. In terms of the last bullet, weather unknown, we do have some dollars baked in for some weather that we have not anticipated, certainly not weather that shuts us down for a week, but maybe something that shuts us down for a day. We've accommodated for that seasonality in the revenue ridership numbers. So, so going forward, the outreach plan that.
She's almost finished, so if you want to come out, I'll stop.
I have one more slide. So the outreach plan deals with a lot of outreach. I know that authority-wide, the general manager has tasked us authority-wide to develop this. Everyone's involved in it, I must say. We're doing open houses, station pop-ups, community events, and online surveys. It's going to be very robust, possibly even more robust than we did 2 years ago, because we've learned our lessons from that. So we're very excited about that outreach. I think you'll be pleased about it when you see the plan laid out for you for that. So the action that we're taking today, or that the board is considering taking today to move to the board, will be the authorization of the public hearings on the proposed budget and the fare changes and the FY 2015 capital and federal grant applications. That's the specific action that will be before you today. And that's the presentation.
Thank you, Ms. Kissel. Before we start with the discussion on the actual resolution and the doc, are there any general questions remaining regarding the staff presentation, including some of the revenue issues outside their specific fare proposals?
Mr. Acosta, point of order. I just want to make sure I understand what the resolution is. Is there a resolution? Okay, there is no resolution moved.
There's a resolution before you.
Is it this alternate that was circulated yesterday?
There's a resolution with attachment of the general manager's proposed fares, and also there are alternates
attached to that, which had been suggested by various board members, and then we will be taking those up separately as possible amendments to the proposed resolution. So, but before we consider that, I just want to make sure that any other questions are put on the table before we consider this. Mr. Walters.
Carol, thanks. With the recent announcement that the Tulsa line is going to be delayed again, do we have that baked into the operating costs? Because that's the second.
So in FY15 that we're speaking about here, I'm assuming a full year of Silver Line, which I'm sure will be in place.
I meant this year.
I'll say that the current surplus that we are experiencing for the first half of this year, I'm pretty confident, and it's not a large surplus. It's a surplus on a $1.7 billion budget is quite small, but I feel confident that we would be able to power through any types of modifications to the schedules.
Okay.
We'll bring that back to you immediately if we feel that there's an issue, but I don't expect one now, no.
One more thing, page 60 of our proposed budget, transit benefit rolls back to $130 a month, not $125. If we are unsuccessful in getting this concert, we'll fix it.
Mrs. Hudgens?
A question about the Title VI initial review. Does the Title VI initial review look at the shift of today's riders that are long riders between the region that are bus riders that will be converted to rail riders?
Jim.
And the reason I ask the question, because there is a great deal of regional travel, mm-hmm. and many of those would be captured today as bus riders, traveling from Prince George's County by rail and bus and moving back to bus in the jurisdictional system. As they get to the Silver Line implementation, that will have a different, I think, impact on folks in terms of what the rail cost will be as to them taking not only a higher fare but a longer distance. So that's why I want to know how this is.
We try to look at that and anticipate as to what that ridership will be. Mm-hmm. Of course, right now, we're really just stepping in the dark. But we do have a general idea as to, with our surveys, as to the people that will be transferring over to the rail ridership. Mm-hmm. And we do take that in consideration when we look at the Title VI total analysis.
Thank you.
Any other general questions for staff?
I just want to make a point, and I failed to do this, but in the attachment that you have before you, there's a series of the programmatic charts that I know you appreciated last time. We did include a management support chart, Mr. Downey, at your request, and we updated the information. I think they're very useful because they give you a one-page snapshot, not just for operating, but capital, and use for your jurisdiction conversations as well. So I just wanted to make that note.
Ms. Melzer.
Just general, Mr. Acosta, is there a place that we could readily find what the different alternative proposals raise?
In terms of revenue, mm-hmm. total revenue?
Yes.
I'll ask Ms. Kissel. You're saying on a document.
Before we even get to the resolution, I want to know, perhaps I'm missing it and it's already here. Like, is item, the Metro Rail fare proposal, how much does it raise? How much do we estimate that it will raise?
Revenue. Go ahead, and then we'll take it.
Is it in the packet, first of all?
No, it's not in the packet.
Okay.
He's got to discuss it.
So I'll just go through the different options very briefly and give a rough estimate of what each of them would raise compared to what our janitor's current proposal is. So option one, which is to have
talking about the general manager's current proposal.
Oh, okay. I can just do that very quickly.
Okay.
The total increase is $1 billion, as Ms. Kissel said. That breaks down into approximately $10 million from bus, approximately $18 million from Metro Rail, about a half a million dollars from Access, and about one half million dollars from parking.
Thank you.
And then when we get to the options, I can add on to that.
Okay. Mr. Goldman had suggested that we take a 5-minute recess to deal with some of the matters. And then are there any objections to that? Okay, so we'll reconvene this and have a discussion about the resolution and the options put forward by various board members when we return. So we'll reconvene at 10:48. If everybody can take their seats, please. I am calling this back to order. We have before us a resolution which authorizes a set of public hearings for
Mr.
the...
Mr. Acosta, just yes. A point of order. Could you clarify what the break was about and what was the meaning of the break? And if there needs to be any disclosure about business discussed at the break?
Yeah, I think it was for personal convenience.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I understand.
I'm just planning ahead.
I appreciate that.
Anticipating needs.
All right. Anyway, we do have before a resolution that would authorize public set of public hearings to go before to take this budget to the public. What I would, we also have printed copies of the resolution, and again, there are five additional options that were proposed for consideration to add to the. Docket that would be put for the for these public hearings. Before we begin, though, just as a matter of procedure, I think it would probably be wise to entertain a motion to adopt this resolution. Second, then we'll have a discussion about the general manager's specific fair proposals, and then after that, we can discuss how we want to handle any of the options. So, in order to put something on the table before we talk about other changes to the docket. So. With that, I would entertain a motion.
Move approval.
By Mr. Downey and second by Mrs. Hudgens. Okay, so we'll have a discussion about the general manager's fair proposals. So, or discussion about that. So, are there any specific questions that you would like to ask or any points that you would like to make regarding the fair proposals that have been put forward by the general manager? That's in attachment A. Hearing none, Mr.
Mr. Chairman, I want to relay the gist of a conversation that I had with the general manager over his recommendations about the docket. We talked about the fact that all the jurisdictions had an interest in maintaining a degree of flexibility for the board to make decisions that might exceed the general manager's recommendation. The general manager's reaction was, my professional responsibility to the board is to make a recommendation about the docket that executes the budget that I've proposed, and that I'm completely comfortable with the board making a decision about a modification of the docket because the board is the convener of the hearing process. The board has to be accountable for what is brought to the hearing. It's always a struggle between retaining enough flexibility for the board after the hearing process is concluded. If the board decides to do something in excess of the recommendation of the general manager and it was not brought to public hearing, we do not have a acceptable public hearing process. So we would have to go back again and have another round of public hearing to modify it. It is not, I don't believe, from the jurisdiction standpoint, of any of the three local jurisdictions, that it is any intent to either be perceived as a criticism of the general manager's docket, nor is it the intent of the board to the jurisdiction request to suggest that a higher set of options is an indication of an intent to raise
fares to those limits. It is to create an environment that is that actually gives legitimacy to the public hearing process by allowing the board to make an informed decision to modify in any way it chooses or thinks this is acceptable at the conclusion of the public hearing process and not have to exercise another round of public hearing if they choose to modify in any way. And as several boards have pointed out, we do this every year as part of the struggle with the docket. But, so this is not an unusual process, but the jurisdictions have given us a set of recommended additions to the docket, and I would suggest, rather than having each jurisdiction go through line item by line item, that it might be amenable to the board adopting those five pages of the addendum in whole as an amendment to the docket. And before I made such a motion, I would encourage some discussion if any of the board feels that it's appropriate to have a discussion about moving the recommendations whole.
Ms. Bowser, then Mr. Nichols.
I would object to that moving them in block.
Mr. Nichols.
I commend the general manager and the team for the budget. I think that put together. And not only in terms of the expense side, but also in terms of the fare side, we're in a much, a greatly improved cycle of review and consideration. And that's an exceptional place to be. Having said that, I think part of what we're trying to accomplish here, at least from my perspective, and I think as we've talked about in Maryland and looking at flexibilities and me personally, what I think Mr. Downs said it best, what choices will we have after the public hearing process and the deliberation that we will go through in terms of examining the budget? I think that this has been a good overview today. We are going to have a lot of discussion around it, and to be able to have flexibility to respond or not to anything that may come forward, I think is what's in it, to preserve the flexibility. And so I'm supportive of doing it that way. I think there's a lot to be discussed on every one of the proposals individually, as well as those that are in the general manager's budget. And so that's why I would support deferring the discussion until we can examine it completely. So that's the only reason. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to turn my phone off first. thank you very much. I agree that the presentation for our budget and the work that's been done here in terms of getting us to proposals that are on the table are very important, and I think we should remind ourselves that this is the consistent process we followed over years in setting fare increases at interims of every 2 years. And the guidance of looking at the CPI and making certain that we are impacting our customers not only in a way. I think it also recognizes the role, the shared responsibility of the funding stream that we have here. But I think the other part that is very important is that we do want to provide the opportunity to have a full discussion. Many of us who are in jurisdictions look at this as the tax advertisement. We advertise a tax rate, and that tax rate is within an envelope of what it's possible for us to do, and it's never a cap of what we will do. And so for some jurisdictions, this is a known part that we have with our citizens. But I think it really does inform the discussion that we're going to have in a much better way. And it's the times in which we have, and I think we've had those examples, in which we've had solutions that we thought we would like to have, but we don't have the opportunity within the advertising limit to do that. And so that means that we may be losing a benefit for the customer that they've brought to us and that they've informed us. So I think it's a very important part that we simply use it as a tool within the general manager's budget to articulate to the public that we're looking broadly and we're seeking their inputs within a broad on discussion.
Thank you. Mr. Dyke.
Just very briefly, I just wanted to associate myself with the comments made by my three colleagues. I agree that this is an appropriate way to approach this and to frame the discussion so that we can get some input from the public and everyone else and then have a pretty well considered discussion later on. So I would support the move of the chair in this direction.
Mr. Dyke?
I would agree with that as well. I think we want to get input. We're not only talking about the hearings, we're talking about outreach, we're talking about questionnaires and surveys. I think we have to do that with a relatively open mind and giving some latitude to what we're going to look at before we make that decision. And we ultimately will make a specific decision would serve us well.
Thank you. Any other comments regarding the proposal? Okay, we have a idea stated by Mr. Downs to perhaps adopt them in block. It was objected to by Ms. Bowser. So, Ms. Bowser, do you have a suggestion as to how to proceed?
I think Robert's rules would suggest that they have to be moved and turned.
Thank you. All right. So, for the public's information, we are now going to consider there are five options that have been put forward in addition to the general manager's proposals. We'll start by considering option one. Option one is a proposal for a 4% increase on Metrorail that would replace the proposed 3% increase. I would entertain a motion to consider this option. Moved by Ms. Hines. Second by Mr. Downey. We have to focus the discussion on this particular matter. So are there any discussions or that anybody would like to raise?
Mr. Acosta, could we have at this point the estimate of what the change over and above what the general manager has suggested is? What amount of money will that raise?
The revenue?
Yes.
Mr. Schofield.
Sure. Just as an introductory point, I think the timing is good. We will be meeting with the JCC next week as part of the regularly scheduled meetings. So the revenue estimates that I'll provide here are rough, and then we can sharpen our pencils over the coming week and provide more detailed information to the JCC next week, if that's okay.
Make a footnote to that, because when we look at the parts and not the sum of a fare increase, could have potential impacts to Title VI analysis. And so we just need to be cautious of that when he provides you that order of magnitude, because one thing might affect something else. And I just want to make that clear.
Mr. Dabby?
And just so I understand where we are, what this would do would allow us to go to hearing 0 to 4 as a range, as opposed to 0 to 3. So we still have the opportunity to come out.
It's a max fare,
right,
as opposed to a final fare.
But could I make a suggestion without having to sharpen your pencil too much, that a 1% increase in rail ridership ought to have a pretty accurate ballpark guesstimate of the revenue impact?
Absolutely.
Yes. And that would answer the question about the difference between a 3 and a 4?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
I'm going to give it right now.
Okay.
The general restoring proposal at 3%, as I said, raises approximately $18 million. So the proposed 4% increase added another $5 to $6 million on top of that. And just so that you understand what that would mean in terms of the actual fares, if you look at boarding charge in the peak, it's currently at $2.10. Under the general manager's proposal, it would be $2.15. With this proposal, it would be $2.20. If you look at the maximum peak fare, for example, under the general manager's proposal, it would be $5.90. On this, with this new option, it would go up to $6.
I'm sorry, what was the increased
dollars? Approximately $5 to $6 million.
Any other questions regarding this amendment?
That's of the 1%. I'm sorry, I just wanted to clarify. The 1% increase for NOVA is $5 to $6 million.
Okay. So that the total would be approximately $24 million.
Okay.
Versus current fares.
Okay. Any other questions? If not, I'll call Mr. Downey.
Yeah, just looking at that. If this did produce an additional $5 to $6 million, that could either reduce subsidy contribution
or be invested in other levels of service improvement.
Any other questions? Mr. Yule.
Not a question, but the comment, and it's probably already been made. I was outside on a phone call, but certainly, you know, appreciate the effort by CEO and staff to produce their proposed draft budget, but I just need to chime in terms of the subsidies to say that, you know, for all the same reasons that WMATA is facing the challenges in terms of budget drive, the threat of sequestration and not knowing what the federal government's going to do and be doing everything else, locally we're experiencing the same set of challenges, so the opportunity or an expectation that certainly my administration can step up to the plate and bear the burden of a subsidy increase is going to be challenging for us as we put our budget together. But I feel obligated to, you know, make that statement. I've made it every year and probably have actually come down on the side of supporting the budget with the subsidy increase. But, you know, again, it's still too early to tell what other, you know, what the impacts will be. But nonetheless, I would like to think that if we can, you know, as we're looking at all of the resources available to us on and laying them on the table, that we try to, you know, strike a balance here.
Thank you. Any other questions? If not, I'll call this amendment to a vote. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment passes. We'll move on to option number two, which is to increase cash surcharge on Metrobus. You'll see it here on your charts. I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Acosta, may I ask a question? In this packet that we have, we actually have two proposals for bus, option two and option three, in the packet, unless I'm misreading. So maybe staff can clarify for us the differences, and whether there's one that's, from their point of view, has more strength or more concerns.
The options have a little bit of overlap, but they are also distinct from each other. The major differences in option two versus what the general manager has proposed, that it would retain the cash surcharge on bus and increase it from 20 cents up to 25 cents, so that you would have a base bus fare that would be $1.75 for smart trip and $2 for cash. That increase can also play out a little bit into the express and the airport fares. That's two. But I would say sort of most importantly, it keeps the base smart fare at the $1.75 level that the general manager has proposed. The major difference with option number three is that it would increase that base charge to $1.85. It would retain the cash surcharge, increase it to 25 cents as done in option two. That increases the cash price then to $2.10. When you change the base fare, that also rolls into the past pricing and things like that. So you'll see the additional changes for that down at the bottom. The proposal did not include, however, any additional changes to the airport or the express fares. It would certainly be possible to sort of meld the two of them together. They're not really in click, and sort of take the maximum pieces of each one if that were something that the board desired.
Can I ask you a question or help you clarify the differences between the two?
Yeah, I guess the other question is the one that Ms. Bowser asked, which is about what is the revenue difference?
Can you answer that question?
Sure. I'm going to answer the two pieces. We haven't exactly looked at how it would be to put them together, but I think it would be mostly just an additive thing. So option two would generate approximately $2 million. There's a little bit on here. Raising the cash surcharge to $2 doesn't generate quite as much as you might think, because a lot of people who pay in cash now are already paying $2 because they don't have $1.80. They just put $2 into the fare box. So that chunk of it would raise about $1 million, perhaps a little bit more. And then the additional changes to the express and the airport fares would raise the other $1 million or so. The option three proposal raises more net revenue because you're talking about an additional increase in base fare up to $1.85. So the estimate of that additional increase in the base fare is approximately $5 million. In terms of what would the impact be, how would people react to having to pay a cash fare of $2.10, that's an area where I would like to sharpen the pencils perhaps a little bit next week to think how people would actually choose to pay that. But again, I think you could probably say that it would generate about an additional $1, maybe a little bit more. So putting the, if you were to merge these two things together, I think the estimate would be on the order of 7 to 8 million, and we can certainly come back and give you a more definite on that prior to the board meeting.
Okay, I just need to step back a bit because we have to put this amendment on. So I would entertain a motion to consider option two. We have a second by Mr. Dyke. Okay, let's proceed with the discussion again. Any other questions regarding option two?
Just a clarifying question. Are we then to consider option three, both option two and option three? Or does
no, we're
one
taking
replace
one at
the
a
other?
Time. We're taking one at a time. So we're okay. Considering option two.
This
time had a question about okay, what's the difference between the two. But we are on the table right now to consider option two.
And may I just understand the general manager's proposal compared to option two? The general manager has suggested raising the base boarding charge from 160 to 175.
Correct.
So everybody pays 175.
Yes.
Okay. And so option two says everybody pays 175 except cash that pays $2. Is that right? Okay.
Are there any other questions regarding this proposed amendment?
Chairman Acosta, just if, since there is some lag between option two and option three, if we approve option two and then want to approve option three, then we may end up sort of replacing parts of one with the other. I just
okay,
so want to be clear with that.
Maybe we should vote on the.
Okay. Yeah.
We could.
Okay. It's to create a menu of options.
Yes.
Yeah, they're not.
And I think we can take the maximum pieces right. of each one.
I mean, we should clarify again for the public. I mean, we are putting forward a series of fare proposals to the public, which, you know, at the end of the day, the board, when it's considering the final budget, may have to consider a somewhat different package. Depending on what it's looking at in terms of fare structure, there may be some questions or changes in subsidy, and there may be changes to the expense side. So at the end of the day, that budget will have to be reconciled in order to make all the pieces fit together. So all we're doing today is the general manager has put forward a proposal which has certain fare changes. What we are considering today are other items that would, to some extent, increase the range. For instance, the last one dealt with adding an increment to it. So that doesn't necessarily mean the board will adopt a maximum on that, but give us the flexibility to consider that if we want to make up perhaps another change to another fair piece of it. So it does allow us to have more ability to assemble a package that we feel will be more amenable to the public as well as our, at the end of the day, our financial position. So, again, this is to put it on the table. It doesn't necessarily mean we are making a decision today. Ms. Bowser?
Mr. Acosta, I just wanted to state for the record that I think that the general manager got it right on this one and that this cash price penalty for bus is the wrong way to go. And I think that the rationale that they presented when they presented the budget holds true now, and I don't think we should move forward in that way. I recognize that this isn't a decision we're making today, but I'll support it later either. So that's,
okay.
I want to say that now, and I'll be voting again. This amendment.
I appreciate that, and I think this doesn't again, necessarily mean that other board members support that measure, but it does mean that we have the ability to discuss it when we are considering the final budget. So I do appreciate that. Mr. Downs.
I'm
think it's very important that we have a clear statement after we finish the set of decisions for our customers. The max in the on the max proposal on bus, the percentage increase would be 15.6%. I certainly have no intent on my part to scare the bejesus out of our bus customers. It's important to have the right language. It's important for the media to understand what we're doing so that the story is not Metro proposes a 16% increase in bus fares as part of the budget adoption. The language is important so that people understand what we're doing. So helping, I think, the staff can help craft that language.
Ms. Hines?
Mr. Costa, I do think we're kind of honing in on what the choices are. I mean, the first vote is really about do we want to advertise a cash surcharge or not. Of a quarter above whatever fare we would end up at is kind of what then. So that's question one. And I, having many, many bus riders in my jurisdiction too, I'm sensitive on this bus price thing. For me, all the way along in this conversation about the cash surcharge, the most important thing has been, is it easy for people to refill a Smart Trip even if all they have is whatever the fare is for that day? And so to me, where I end up on this is going to partly depend on what my understanding is and what the work is around making it easy to load your Smart Trip off the bus. And if we don't have a better answer than sort of the patchwork we've been doing, then perhaps it is time for it to go away. Like many things, it doesn't necessarily bother me for the tourist who wants to take one ride to pay $2 or $2.10. But for our regular, ordinary folks who ride the bus, I don't want to penalize them if they're mostly in a cab economy. So I think, you know, that's a linkage that I make to this particular thing. We're not the answer yet, so I'm willing to leave it alive. But I think the answer actually matters.
Thank you. Any other question, Mr. Giancola?
Yeah, I think it's a couple things. Page 97 also talks about Metro bus customer satisfaction, and there's been a general trend going down. I don't know what the specifics were identified as the dissatisfaction. Certainly a major drop from last year, from July to September to now. You know, it could be pricing. It could be just the fact that our roads are more congested, but I don't know why. But secondly, it's also important to be reminded, what is our current cost recovery on both rail versus bus on fares, fare recovery?
On rail, if you look at passenger fares plus parking, it's approximately 69% or 7%. If you add in all the operating revenues, you know, the advertising, the fiber optics, all that, then it gets up to 75%. For bus, the recovery is more in the range of 25, 26, 27%.
But I would remind you that cost recovery ratio does not include the cost of capital to run the rail system. We just kind of assume that that's separate money. In any kind of other business, you would measure your fare box against your total cost of operations. We do not do that, and because bus is lighter on capital, it winds up being an apples and oranges comparison, but a lot of transit systems are struggling with how to accurately define fare box. There is no contribution for capital on rail, and it is the most significant driver of cost.
Ms. Pudgett.
I'm sort of repeating myself, and it's, as we expand this discussion about what options, and we're looking in the equity of it, of the options, that we recognize that the shift in ridership is a larger regional ridership, and it includes rail. And so when we are cautious as to what the bus fare should be, we have to recognize that, first of all, there is an equal opportunity for us to ride bus, but also some people are truly dependent upon rail. Travel from Largo to Silver Line, it will probably be bus, a rail ride, not a bus ride. So I think when we have this discussion later, we really should try and understand what the Title VI says and where we are able to collect that data, what that impact, and we can talk later about maybe some tools to provide us to be able to look at those beyond the Title VI.
Thank you. Any other questions for any option number two? If not, I'll call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed?
No.
We have one. Next is over. The amendment passes. We'll move on to option number three, which is to increase the base, base Metro bus fare to $1.85 and cash surcharge to 25 cents. Moved by Mr. Dyke. Second. Second by Mr. Goldman, I'm sorry. Are there any questions regarding option number three? If not, I'll call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
No.
We have one. Option number three passes. Next up is option number four, which is an additional 50-cent surcharge at parking facilities in Prince George's County. I would entertain.
I'll move.
Moved by Mr. Nichols.
Second.
Second by Mrs. Hampshire Cowan. Any discussion on this particular proposal? Now I'll call the question. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Option number five is a convention pass that would be added to the docket. Moved by Ms. Bowser. Second by Mrs. Hudgens. Any questions regarding this proposal?
Question about the nature of the pass, which I think is a great idea. Would it be time limited? Well, if you bought convention pass, or if your convention manager bought passes for all their people, can be limited to roughly the length time of that convention?
That's one of the things I want staff to come back with a recommendation. Right. I have the same question. Yeah. Have to develop a little more.
The big deal for us is those people who don't take the ride, but you really want to get
exactly. Exactly.
Mr. Costa, one question.
Yes.
It would be available to not only DC conventions, but if there were a smaller convention type meeting in other jurisdictions.
Similar type organizations.
Yeah.
Yes, Mr. Goldman.
We asked staff for an estimate of revenue, increased revenue from the other options. Could staff provide a revenue estimate for the convention pass?
Yes, we have an estimate in actually in the board memo that was sent to you all that explains sort of the concept of it and the discussions that we've had. But we can certainly add that into all the others when we present it.
I have it here. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah, I can.
Do you have it?
Do you want to talk? Or
yeah, we have it.
So the construct of the pass is a pilot program for 1 year in which we would measure the marketability of the pass price point that we've proposed using the district's Convention and Visitors Bureau as the model, which has next year planned 16 large conventions with participants of 200,000, the price point of $30 would earn $6 million in revenue if we had 100% utilization of the pass. We don't expect the first year of the program. The target would be 1.5 million, roughly 25% penetration of the market.
Thank you. Mr. Bulger.
Are we going to do an MOU with Destination DC as the pilot, Lynn, or is it just going to be ad hoc on the 16 conventions that are planned for?
No, we would do a memorandum of agreement because the this would be a channel marketing agreement so that the passes would be marketed by the CVB and then fulfilled by the CVB to their clients. So in other words, when they go out to market convention space, hotel room nights with the meet planners and so forth, the travel expense would be part of that attractive package. And what we know from the Destination DC is that they're competing with other East Coast cities, New York, Atlanta, who all discount their transit for large groups like this. And so they feel that they're currently at a disadvantage from a competitive standpoint relative to having affordable transportation as part of their sales pitch.
Mr. Acosta.
Yes, ma'am.
First, I want to really thank the staff for following up on this issue so quickly. We had a conversation about it, and I know you met with the Destination DC folks. Just think it's going to be, and I think you priced it well, and I'm hoping that a lot of the convention goers will take advantage of it. I just also want to note that while Destination DC is going to be primarily marketing it, convention goers, they stay in hotels all across the region. So this is really going to be a truly regional benefit. So I want to commend you, and I look forward to supporting this.
Thank you. Any other questions regarding this option? Mrs. Hudgens?
And I wanted to add, when you say the marketing is all across the region, that means that you would visit Virginia and visit Fairfax and all of those, or your MOU is Destination DC, and you are doing what in that MOU then?
Yes, ma'am. So what we propose to do is have a one-year pilot with an agreement with Destination DC so we could work out the logistics of this kind of channel marketing, test the price point, see what the market will bear, see how it plays out, and then we could expand those agreements across the region with other CVBs.
And you're saying a one-year pilot?
One-year pilot.
And you believe that that pilot would allow you to readily implement afterwards?
Yes.
And I say that because this region is getting ready to do the World Games in 2015, which we'll see more people can think of. And I think it is important to think about whether or not this is the right MOU agreement or how to flexibly increase your exposure. Mm-hmm. For the
Thank you. That's a good point. We'll consider more about that.
The key thing is, you can ask for proof of the product.
Right.
The MOUs, and if we're very successful in the pilot in the first few months, and we want to feel we can move on, then we move on.
Mr. Downey, do you have a question?
One about the convention. Convention planners are usually looking years ahead. So talking about working with Destination DC during 2014 for conventions that will actually occur much later date. So.
Yeah, I don't think that there's anything that precludes them from going back to existing agreements and offering that expense, okay. But I think you're right that sort of samples the market for the
right.
future.
So it may be longer than a year to play through.
That's right.
But hopefully that's some early readings that it is.
That's right. Just
and
because
it will be a success.
They, like we, are interested in testing the sort of price sensitivity of their planners.
A question on Title VI. When will the various proposals be looked at in terms of doing a final decision? I mean, now that we're going out with a range of options, I'm thinking it may make sense to do a Title VI review at the extreme, or else wait till we adopt a package. But we can't act officially on a final package till we have a Title VI.
Absolutely right, and some of this stuff could take a couple of months. So I have to sit with staff after I saw all these options and figure out perhaps what's the most extreme in terms of impact on low-income and minorities, and see how that fits in the envelope, and then try to work back. That's just the top of my head. I have to say.
Will you let us know how you plan to?
Yes, I will do it.
That will be an input into our process.
Thank you. Any other questions regarding option number five? If not, I'll call the amendment to a vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? The amendment passes. Are there any items or options that anybody would like to bring to the table after this point before we consider the final resolution? Hearing none, again, I would like to commend the general manager and his staff for their preparation of this budget. I know it's always a difficult situation when we have to propose any fare changes, and we understand the amount of angst and problems that may create for our customers in the long term. And we do this with that knowledge, and we will always try our best to make sure that we do this in a fair manner and one that essentially protects the public in the day. We are looking very hard at efficiencies internally in order to cut costs over the time. And again, I believe the staff will continue to do so but as they make their presentations to us about some of the management efficiencies that they are undertaking. So again, it is a difficult situation. This is also an issue where we are just bringing this out to the public for discussion. So in essence, we are advertising this docket to allow us to have this discussion as part of our public hearing. And again, the amendments that were added to the resolution give us more flexibility and more ability to essentially hear what the public has to say about them and ultimately craft a package that will do the best for our customers as well as do the best for the authority. So with that, I will call for a vote on the resolution as amended, options 1 through 5. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? The resolution passes. Unfortunately, we have one more agenda item on this committee meeting, and this is the future NVTA Metro 2025 investment resolution. Ms. Kissel.
I think I'll do this one.
Okay.
At least I'll start off.
All right.
As we've been talking to many stakeholders who potentially could provide funding towards Metro 2025, one of the questions that comes up occasionally is, well, if we put it in, our jurisdiction puts it in, how are we the jurisdiction is going to put it in, match it, or are we out there by ourselves? And my general response has been, and the observation of this board, is usually they all get together and they move forward. No one gets out there by themselves. But this question became more to the point very recently where we had applied for funding in Virginia under the new funding system for a couple of initiatives that would be part of Metro 2025, having to do with additional buses, bus service, as well as beginning some work on the traction power for 8-car trains. And the question has come back to us, well, if we put this in, you know, we get credit for this. So what I felt was it might be appropriate for the board to basically say in the form of resolution that these projects, in this particular case, Northern Virginia, first of all, that we want to accelerate Metro 2025 as much as possible, get it going, because there's a lot to be done, and you know, time frame is not that far away. The second was, with regard to this specific thing, as an example of the concern, was to say that it would be credited to your future Metro 2025 contribution, because you're stepping up early, in case you know the rest of 2025 fell apart, which I don't anticipate happening. So it was to say to the jurisdictions, if you put up the money now in advance of a new funding agreement, yeah, we'll credit it to 2025. And as the resolution says, in the extraordinarily unlikely event that go ahead with the project and Metro 2025 doesn't come about, at least in that area, that the contribution would be part of your normal contribution to the state. So it's sort of saying, look, if you stand up early and provide some funding, it's going to count to the funding that you're expected to provide eventually under the prorated system that we have. It was a sort of message from the board. So that's why it's before you for consideration.
Thank you, Mr. Sarles. Are there any questions regarding this proposal?
Mr. Costa, we on the Virginia side really appreciate that this has been called out and that we're seeking a way to manage not only NVTA's potential funding of initiatives, any jurisdiction that finds a way to step in and cover a piece of what is in Metro 2025. There are a couple of issues with the way the resolution is written. In our particular case, the last thing which Mr. Sarles just talked about actually isn't allowed by the way our legislation is funded. NVTA funds specific projects. The dollars can't be redirected should Metro 2025 not occur. So we would, from the Virginia side, respectfully request that be deferred in that JCC have a conversation that looks not only to this NVTA issue, but contemplates a set of policy guidance that could be applied for any jurisdiction that, and I'll give the one I always give because it's my favorite, you know, you work with a developer who agrees to help pay for putting in some station enhancement that's part of Metro 2025. How does that get accounted for? That's another issue that sort of lurks out there, I think, for all of us. And one my point of view, want to embrace because it brings non-governmental dollars into our program to help solve some of the significant challenges. So there may be other examples that people can think about, but we think the intention is great, and we think with a little more work with JCC, we can get to something that will guide all of this moving forward and not just be specifically about MBTA.
Comment question, just as a clarification, and that certainly could be handled in the wording of the resolution. It was not intended that by wording at the end of the resolution that the money could then be used for anything. The money, which would be reflective in the actual MOA signed with Virginia, said it could only be used for those specific projects. So that would take care of that. My only other concern is, as I said before, is that this suggestion came about as a result of what we were hearing in terms of approval of the funding. If this does not inhibit Northern Virginia from providing that funding, certainly as much time as possible to come to a broader resolution, nor if it doesn't inhibit filing for next year's funding, which I understand is coming up in January. So if it inhibits neither of those, certainly, it can take time to do it.
Be in a stronger position to answer that question.
I'm sorry, I was reading, and what were you saying? What was your
going back to the comment that was made, and why I even suggested this resolution was because of the feedback we were getting that there was concern about providing the funding to WMATA to proceed with these two projects that had initially approved. If that is not a concern, in fact, that approval is going to go ahead, absent some kind of stigma, then there's no limit on time. The second part of my question was with regard to for the next fiscal year. I understand those applications are due in January, and the lack of saying anything on the subject, would that inhibit consideration of those applications?
Wearing my hat as vice chair of the NBTA and chairman of the NBTA Finance Subcommittee. We actually have a Finance Committee Subcommittee meeting tomorrow afternoon, and we can reflect on this as well, and a board meeting, NBTA meeting next Thursday the 12th. My initial reaction response would be no. I don't think it creates a problem, and so it gives us time to address that.
And I guess we might suggest that we should bring this back in February. We are in the midst of a bond validation suit, and we don't expect to hear back earlier than February from the courts, which would validate all of the money. So no money can flow until after.
Mr. Downey, question.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's great. Oh, I didn't know we won. Never mind.
So we want to do this again?
Never mind.
Mr. Downey had a question.
Yeah, a question. Just again to make sure I understand the context here. These funds and these projects would fall above the line in that chart. These are 2025 projects.
Yes.
Yes, and it's kind of a down payment on the unfunded 2025. It's not in any way a substitute for support that we would hope to get for the base program.
Correct.
Great, thank you.
Mrs. Hines, you had suggested that we defer this. This is still something you would like to defer?
Oh, yeah. I think that this, that the policy idea behind this is actually very important for the board to articulate. I think it will serve us in good stead as we all move forward in figuring this out. And I think in the long run, it's a good practice and a good policy to have. I do think we can finish this up shortly. I think the JCC has some questions about how it would be implemented. It goes to this issue Mr. Downey just spoke of what's, how does it substitute in? I think we need to work through that. But I would suggest we try to bring a policy statement back in the Fed time frame.
Well, I would suggest that we already talked about having the JCC and staff get together with regard to the entire Metro 2025 program. This would be another item on the agenda.
Okay. And I think we have to make
Ms. Bowser.
Just a question for the general manager. Is there an analogous situation with the other jurisdictions?
I've heard not specifically analogous. I've heard the comment in other jurisdictions about, well, if we put in, will everybody put in? I will acknowledge that when I was with the mayor and the district council at recent press, that there was a resounding, we're putting the money in from the district council.
Okay, if there are no objections, we will defer this matter to a future committee meeting. Are there any other matters to be brought before the committee? I would be remiss if I did not thank Mark Pohl of the staff who had prepared many of the amendments that you've seen today in short order. So very, my thanks to Mr. Pohl. Any other matters? This meeting is adjourned. Thank you.